won't find it there. For once the guns stop blazing, you'll find it amazing how the world can drag on just as before. If you're seeking freedom in a marble mansion, oh, if you're seeking freedom, you won't find it there. For even when it's sunny, you'll be counting money, keeping up that showcase, your face lined with care. If you're seeking freedom on a throne of power, or if you're seeking freedom, you won't find it there. For though men all obey you, what if they betray you? Tense you'll be and waiting for foes everywhere. Seeking freedom, cast away desires, why barter like a beggar, you've wealth everywhere. For never can you buy it, grasp and you'll deny it, freedom can't be hoarded, it's free as the air. If you're seeking freedom, seek it on the mountains, got sunlight on your shoulders, the wind in your hair. For there's no one can hold you, boss about or mold you. Once your heart is free, you'll be king everywhere. For there's no one can hold you, boss about or mold you. Once your heart is free, you'll be king everywhere.
My second song is Gone Alone.
Let come who will, but if they So, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Inner Renewal Week 2013. And we also want to welcome those who are watching us online in our virtual community and in many far-flung places. Well, as you're probably aware, also I just want to welcome all our friends from Palo Alto who has come up in as a group. We're very happy you can join us. As you're probably aware, our theme for Inner Renewal Week this year is how to know God through the scriptures. Okay, and I thought I would start by reading a brief quote from one of the scriptures we'll be examining, the Bhagavad Gita. This is from chapter 16, verse 34. Take true scripture, therefore, as your guide in determining what should be done and what should be avoided. With intuitive understandings of the injunctions in Holy Writ, perform your earthly duties. So this is what we're going to be trying to do this week, to intuitively perceive the meaning behind these great scriptures. And first of all, let's go back and ask ourselves the question, what is a scripture? And it's, as Yogananda explains, it's revealed wisdom. It's higher wisdom that has been revealed through God contact of great souls, and then it has been written down. Scripture comes from the Latin word scriptore, to write. And so it's God coming, revealing wisdom and guidance, how to live your life in order to find God, and then great saints and sages, disciples and saviors through the ages have recorded this so that we might understand them, that so it can be not just lost in time, not entirely misinterpreted and misquoted as the ages go down, as it comes down through the ages. And so for us, what we're trying to do is bring these two thoughts together. During Inner Renewal Week, we've created this week for our deeper community members to give us a chance. Spiritual Renewal Week is more outward and serving others. Inner Renewal Week is a time for us to study the teachings, to go deeper in meditation, to make significant inroads in the direction we want to. And what we'll be focusing on this week is how to use the scriptures. The four scriptures we'll be focusing on are the Bhagavad Gita, which Jyotish will be speaking about after my introduction. And the title of the class is Driving Your Chariot to Freedom. So the Gita picks up this spiritual teachings from the point of view of the inner challenge that every soul faces with the warriors within ourselves, the warriors that pull us down into material consciousness and the warriors that lift us up into God communion. The Gita comes to us from, it was written down by an ancient sage, Beda Vyasa. And it, of course, is a dialogue, as most of us know, between the avatar Krishna, who is Babaji, and his dear disciple Arjuna, who is our guru, master. And Krishna lived about in descending Dwapara, so about 9,000 BC. When the Gita was actually written, I don't know we have exactly, but it would have been sometime after that. What did I say, 9,000? Excuse me, 900, okay, 900. It's a good thing that wasn't a check. So 900 BC, same as that I've done. Okay, so that we're starting in descending Dwapara. Then the next, this isn't in the order of the classes, but we will be also looking at Patanjali. And what Patanjali, came to us, again, we don't know exactly, maybe about 300 BC. And Patanjali was a great master, said he was an avatar. So that's no small accomplishment. But he didn't necessarily create this roadmap through driving the vehicle of yoga and meditation to our goal of God communion, but he codified it. He brought it down. He created what had been existing because he knew, again, here we are in a descending age, he knew this wisdom would be lost. So he did it in very pithy little sutras, little sentences. And they're, some of them are rather obscure. We'll be studying masters or masters' interpretations through Swami demystifying Patanjali. So we're moving in historical order. Then we come to the Bible, written by the four, we're talking primarily the New Testament, written by four disciples, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, describing the life of Jesus, another great avatar, who is also one of our line of gurus. And this came as Jesus' life, as we know, they say he died in 33 AD, so around the very bottom, the very nadir of Dwapara Yuga, before it started coming up. And then finally, we'll study the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which was written by a Persian mystic, Omar Khayyam, who is also an enlightened sage. The date of his death is 1100 approximately AD. So we're spanning 2,000 years of scriptures here. And yet, different cultures, different spiritual needs were addressed, different times, obviously. But they all express in different ways, from different points of view, the same truth. And this brings us to the mission of our great master, who came to show particularly the underlying unity of original Christianity as expressed in the Bible and original Hinduism as expressed in the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. I shouldn't say Hinduism, the original teachings of Krishna as expressed in the Bhagavad Gita. And so Master, not only was it his mission to show the underlying unity in these great scriptures, but he did more than that. He gave us commentaries on each of these great scriptures. I mean, what an amazing thing. If he had just said, look for the underlying truth, that would have been a gift. But he took the time and the working with deep intuitive perception of God to unlock the hidden mysteries in these scriptures, some of them thousands of years old. And he gave us his Gita commentaries, his Bible commentaries, his commentaries on Omar Khayyam and on Patanjali. And these are not just commentaries the way that most scriptural scholars do, where they study the original language and they look at what other people have said. Recall Master said about his work on the Bhagavad Gita. He said, now I know why my guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, would never let me study any other interpretations, because he wanted me to tune in to the original thinking of Beda Vyasa and draw only from that purity of source, from one avatar to another great enlightened soul. And so this is what he did. Master said, I tuned in until finally I made that inner contact with Beda Vyasa, and I knew what he meant. I knew the inner meaning, the symbolism, and the allegorical meaning of each passage in the Gita. You know, those of us who have worked for Ananda in India, we've heard over and again from Indians saying, I have read the Gita from childhood, I was raised on it, but I never understood it till I read Yogananda's commentaries. And interestingly, remember in the path Swamiji mentions, he was out at 29 Palms with Master when he was working on the Gita commentaries. And when he finished, he called Swamiji over and he said, a new scripture has been born, meaning these commentaries. Millions will find God through this scripture. Not thousands, but millions. I know. I have seen it. And so it's of great importance that we study, particular these Gita commentaries. But then the same, if you read with, Master did the same thing with Omar Khayyam. He said he meditated until, obviously he couldn't read the original Persian, but he meditated until he said, in a moment I felt the veils breaking down. I was able to pierce the veil and I understood what Omar Khayyam was saying. And so it was the same process, and with Patanjali, and with, to finish the thought of Omar Khayyam, if you remember Swami telling the story, once he was giving, I think it was in Australia, but I'm not sure, it doesn't really matter. Okay, I get a nod from our historical expert here. It was in Australia, and he was expounding on Master's commentaries on the Rubaiyat. And one man said, you know, I read the verse in English, and Master's commentary, or Yogananda's commentary, doesn't seem to at all refer to what the verse was. And Swami said, well, all I can say is this is the interpretation he gave. But there was a woman sitting in the audience who raised her hand, and she said, I am from Persia, and I can read the original Persian. And what the translation misses, the English translation by Edward Fitzgerald, misses the point. What Yogananda was responding to was true to the verse in the original Persian. So it's, again, tuning in to the deeper meaning of these things. And with Patanjali, really, when you look at what Master taught, Patanjali is at the heart of all of it. The path to God, the goal, the way to samadhi through right action, and he, you know, volumes about how to live properly in this world through meditation, volumes about the art and science of Raja Yoga, and the goal, his great poem, Samadhi, which we find, and if we can memorize it and use it as our guidepost every day for the consciousness that we're striving for. So these four great scriptures that our guru has gone deep into, and what we will be sharing this week are his commentaries based on them. And, you know, some years ago, 2003, when Ananda was first starting the work in India, we had moved into an ashram house, poetically called B10x8, and we did get a better name for it, I think, eventually, but that's what it was known as for quite a long time. And Swami was in a little apartment on one floor, and there were different people were moving in. But we were visited by one of our great Indian friends and saints, Devi Mukherjee, who many of us have had the blessing of knowing him. He wrote that beautiful little book, Shaped by Saints. He was a direct disciple of Anandamoyi Ma. Swamiji had met him as a young monk. He had started out as one of Ma's monks. Swami had met him as a young man in India. But through guidance, Devi eventually married Hashi Bose, who was the son of Tulsi Bose, a master's boyhood friend. And they lived together in that house, Hashi and Devi, which was very near to Forgarpur Road, where Master's boyhood house, and Master spent much time in that house, as well as other great saints. It was visited by no less personages than Abhiji, Sri Teshwar, Anandamoyi Ma, and there are relics there that are sacred beyond reckoning. And so Devi, a humble, simple man, came to visit Swamiji. And he was just staying very simply in one of the little rooms in B10x8. And one morning, we went to greet Swamiji, and he said, Devi, to me, go ask Devi Mukherjee if he will come up and have breakfast with me. So I went downstairs, and I knocked on Devi's door. And very quietly, this refined voice had come in. And I opened the door, and there was Devi, seated on the floor in lotus pose with his Brahmin thread in a simple loincloth, a dhoti, with a little straw mat on the floor where he had slept. And he was totally immersed in the Bhagavad Gita. Who knows how many countless times he read it. But as my eyes beheld that scene, it was like I was in another age. I was looking at a vision that had been transpired probably millions of times down through history, of the simple devotee getting up from his morning prayers, immersed in divine consciousness, reading the Gita. And so with each of these great scriptures, there have been souls throughout time who have drawn great inspiration. And so I dedicate our week together in a renewal week, both to our great guru who illumined these scriptures for us, and to the millions of souls who have gone before us, who have drawn God contact through reading these words and immersing themselves in these blessings. So let us feel throughout this week, as we go deep in meditation and prayer, as we are inspired by our teachers throughout the week, by the ceremonies and so forth, the kirtans, let us feel that we are moving out of time and space, and we are held in that timeless realm where God speaks to us through the scriptures.
Now, those of you who have had previous classes with us on the Bhagavad Gita can probably guess what's in this bag. And those who haven't, this is rather fun. This is the way we start our classes on the Gita. Khanchas play an important part in the Gita, but we'll come to that in a minute. I suppose we all have our own personal samskars, meaning tendencies from past lives and ways that we've developed and particular preferences. But for me, the Gita is the essence of the essence of the spiritual life, especially once one begins to understand it through the interpretations or the explanations of Master and Swamiji. It is so deep and yet so immediately present and important to our lives and our own guidance. I know Devi read the passage from the Gita about studying it through intuition. Well, thank goodness we don't have to rely on our own intuition, but have masters to help us, because the Gita in particular is written in layers. It's an allegory, and so it has consistent levels of what it's talking about. And so taken on just the surface level, as one reads it, there is a teaching there, and it can be understood on that surface level. And it is consistent. It gives wonderful advice on how to live one's life and how to carry on in this world. And yet, if one understood it only on that level, then we would be like millions and millions and millions of people who faithfully read a scripture without understanding 1/1000th of the meaning of that scripture. What's in the Gita is incredibly deep and incredibly pertinent to our lives. When I first read the Gita, I had been on the path just very briefly, really. I had met Swamiji and taken a class or two from him, and then I went on a kind of a summer vacation to the redwoods down near San Jose and in that area. And I camped out for a week, and during that week I meditated quite a bit and I read the Bhagavad Gita. But I had not yet gotten any explanation of it. And in fact, the reading of it without an explanation almost took me off the spiritual path. I'll explain that a little bit later, but it is wonderful, wonderful that we have the explanation of Master who tuned into Vyasa, because for one thing, all of the names in the Bhagavad Gita, for us, they're just kind of foreign-sounding names with a lot of syllables that make it really hard for us to pronounce or remember. And yet, every one of those names has a deep inner meaning to it that explains what that name is about. So, just to give a little bit of history or backstory to the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita is a small part of one of the longest epic poems or scriptures in existence, the Mahabharata. Bharata means light, Maha means great, so this is the great light that is coming to enlighten us. And that scripture, that long epic poem, is basically the story of a family, one family, that has two branches. And those two branches are at war with each other. And the tensions increase and increase until at the end of the, well, midway through the scripture, but at the end of the build-up, the two sides end up going to war. And then there is a huge war that lasts for 18 days, and it's described in detail. And by the end of that war, basically everybody on both sides is wiped out, is dead. There are just a few remaining people of the main characters in it. And so the story of that warfare is a very, very wonderful study in psychology once one understands what's going on. If one doesn't, it seems terrible. And that's what basically just about took me off the path. Because there is at the beginning, well, just to place the Gita. So the Gita takes place on the eve, the night before that battle is about to start. And I'll explain, but Krishna has agreed to be Arjuna's charioteer. Now, the chariot represents the body, and a charioteer is one who drives the body, and often there's one these wonderful Indian art posters showing Krishna and Arjuna and the white horses that are pulling the chariot out in between the two armies. And Krishna, the avatar, has agreed to be the charioteer for Arjuna, but not to fight. So he's holding the reins of the horses. What that represents is the five horses represent the five senses. And because Krishna has those horses, those senses under control, and is able to move with them, it means that the enlightened soul has withdrawn his senses and has them under control so that he is able to then use the body in the way that it is meant to be used, which is to bring us to divinity. And so the field of Kurukshetra, where this battle takes place, is an actual field. Remember I said there are levels and levels? There's an actual place. There's a current town of Kurukshetra near New Delhi in India. There's the field of Kurukshetra. There's where the battle took place. But the real field of Kurukshetra is the body, and most especially the spine. And so there's a historical level that's going on. There are real characters from history. But Vyasa has used those characters in order to weave in deep, deep symbolic truths that will enlighten us. So the Gita, as I say, is set on the eve before the battle. And Arjuna asks Krishna to bring him out in between the two armies so that he can look at the two armies and see who it is that we're going to end up fighting. Because these are members of one family, as I said, two branches of one family, but one family. And I'll read a section where Arjuna, looking at all the people that he needs to fight, becomes dispirited. The first chapter is called The Despondency of Arjuna. Becomes dispirited because there is cousins and fathers and grandfathers and teachers and sons and people that he loves and has grown up with. Well, how did they grow up together? Well, here's the interesting part. We now begin to get into the bit of the psychology behind where the Gita is and where the Mahabharata is. There was a king, and that king, I'll simplify it because we don't have much time and I don't want to spend it all on the backstory. Seems a little bit almost irreverent to take a scripture like the Gita or the Bible or Patanjali or the Omar Khayyam, the Rubaiyats, and spend a day on them and think that we've somehow studied them. So I can't spend very much time on the backstory, but there are two sons, and those two sons have their children. And the children of those two sons are the heroes and anti-heroes in this. But one son is Pandu, the other is Dhritarashtra, who is the head of the Kauravas. They represent, Dhritarashtra is the elder son, he represents the blind or sensory mind. And he's actually physically blind in this story. So it's the blind mind and his son Pandu, his brother Pandu, represents discrimination. Represents discrimination is centered here. The sensory mind is centered here in the body. And so we're talking now about psychology, but we're also talking about two families. All right, their children are the ones who are going to fight this battle. And the sons of Pandu are five children, the Pandavas. The son of Dhritarashtra are 100 children, led by Duryodhana, who's the elder of the clan. Well, Pandu dies, and so the Pandavas, the five Pandavas, are taken in by the other branch of the family, the Kauravas, and they grow up there, and so they grow up together. That's why they're like cousins, they're like brothers, they have the same teachers, they have the same revered grandfather, they share an enormous amount. What they represent are our psychology, and they represent the downward pulling tendencies of us and the upward lifting tendencies. The Pandavas, in fact, there are five of them. They represent the five chakras, our spiritual centers. Duryodhana and his brothers, there are 100 of them. Really, there are innumerable, and it says that in one of the passages. But that represents the fact they're the worldly tendencies, the sensual tendencies, the downward pulling tendencies. And there are hundreds of them. They represent anger and lust and greed, and you get the seven deadly sins and all their kin mixed in with it. They represent all of those things, and yet they represent also our body, our personality, and our tendencies. And so those two are at war. And the Duryodhana is especially, he's terribly jealous about the Pandavas because they outshine him at everything. They're brighter, they're bigger, they're stronger, they're smarter, they're faster. But he's the elder brother and he's the real son of the kingdom that they're living in, and he should be in charge of everything. And then these guys, they're always getting in his way, and it's just an awful dilemma. So he does what any normal kid would do. He tries to kill him. He tries to poison him. It doesn't work. He tries to burn him. It doesn't work. He tries everything he can to get rid of them. Finally, he gets them into a gambling match and gets them expelled from the kingdom. But they come back after the prescribed time and they want their half back. And Duryodhana says, I will not give you back so much territory as can be covered by a straw. What that means is our internal downward pulling tendencies look at our spiritual side and say, no, 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 you aren't getting my territory. I am after money, I'm after fame, I'm after men and women, and I'm after fast cars and a fast life. And now you think you're going to come in and change all of that? No way. You can't have so much of my mental territory as is covered by a straw. And the Pandavas say, but it's our rightful territory. And so what else can we do but go to war? And that's what the Gita represents. It's what the Mahabharata represents. The internal war that is constantly raging in us. Everything in this world is built on duality, and the internal duality represents our downward, outward-going, sensual, sensory tendencies that want to rule master called the kingdom of the mind. All of our thoughts are like mental citizens, and so the Kurava part of us, the sensory part of us, wants to rule that kingdom. And the Pandava part of us wants also to rule it and bring it to enlightenment. And those two are at war. Well, a little bit before the Gita starts, and I'm going to start with this, as I say, it's a little bit irreverent to try to understand these scriptures. So what I'm going to do is to try to take five key points. These are things to take away from the Gita that will change your life if you can understand them and live them. And so the first takes place before the actual Gita. This is how Krishna becomes the charioteer to Arjuna. And so this war, imminent war, has built up, and they realize, that both families realize, that there's no way to avoid it anymore. So Duryodhana and Arjuna both get on their fastest horses and they rush to the kingdom of Krishna, who's their cousin, because they both want to get Krishna to fight on their side. And if they can get Krishna to fight on their side, they know, because his army is vast and he is undefeatable himself, they know that they're going to win the war. And so they rush there. And when they get there, Krishna is sleeping. But they're both, because they're family members, they're allowed into the sleeping chamber. And Duryodhana, being prideful and the way that he is, there's a kind of throne-like chair beside Krishna's head, and he goes and he pompously sits there. And Arjuna, being, well, Swamiji called him disciple everyone. He's the symbol of discipleship. He goes and he stands at the bed, at the foot of the bed of Krishna. Well, Krishna is pretending to be asleep. And so Krishna kind of opens his eyes and he looks and he sees, oh, Arjuna, you're here. And then he turns his head. He says, oh, Duryodhana, you're here. What in the world could you two want? This is omniscience. And so they both explain that they want him to be on their side. And he says, well, I love you both equally because the spirit has become this body. It's not like the body, the world, all of the activity of the world is something hateful to God. He's become all of that. He is all of that. And so that too is precious to him. And so Krishna says, you're both precious to me, but now I have a real dilemma because you both want my help, and yet I feel, since you're both precious to me, that I need to help you both. It seems only righteous, only dharmic to me. He says, Arjuna, I saw you first when I opened my eyes, because he was there humbly at the foot of the bed. And also, you're the youngest, and by tradition, you have first choice. And so here's the quote from the Mahabharata. You came to me first. I saw Arjuna first. You came to me first, meaning Duryodhana was the first to come into the bedchamber. But I saw Arjuna first. Hence, I think it is but right that I should help you both. Arjuna, and then he offers that help. He says, Arjuna, you're the younger. I'm going to give you first choice. And he says, Arjuna, you had better think well before you make your choice. You have the army on one hand, and on the other, a weaponless, non-fighting Krishna. So what he has offered, he has this enormous army. And since he owes something to both of them, he says, to one of you I will give my army, all of the soldiers who are equal in valor to me, thousands and thousands of soldiers. On the other hand, there's me, and I will offer to drive the chariot for one of you, but I will not fight, and I not only will not fight for you, I will not even have any weapons with me. I'll simply drive the chariot. And so he's given this choice now first to Arjuna. And Arjuna, it goes on, Arjuna fell at the feet of Krishna. You, my Lord, I want you. I do not want anything else in this world. I want you. Duryodhana was very happy to get the large army of Krishna. He felt that without the army and without the weapons, Krishna could not be of much help to the Pandavas. So that's, in some ways, the most important point, the turning point in this scripture. Now, what that represents for us is that we, too, are given that choice. We're given that choice every day. We can either choose God, because what Master said is everyone in this world is motivated by the same thing. We want happiness and we want to overcome pain. It's how we achieve that goal that differs. And so here we are, both sides. We want Duryodhana too. He wants the same thing Arjuna wants. He wants happiness. He wants to avoid pain. But he's got his own tactics, his own way of going about it. And Arjuna has another set of values and another set of tactics. And so we too, especially as devotees, have that same choice. God promises us, I'll help either one of your tendencies. They're both precious to me. Your worldly tendencies, I don't mean, you know, terrible, awful, go to the discos and get drunk necessarily kind of tendencies. These worldly tendencies are the tendencies that think that we will find our happiness by things of this world, that we'll find our happiness by possessions, we'll find our happiness by power or by fame or by any of the other millions of desires that 999 people out of 1,000 in this world have. They have those because they think that that will make them happy. And Krishna is saying here, if that's if that's the way that you think that you will be happy, I'm going to help you. I'm going to offer you my army. Thousands and thousands of soldiers to help you be victorious in that life. So the spiritual energy empowers us all. It's in every cell of our body. It's in our senses. It's everywhere. And if that's the choice that we make, the spiritual element, God will help us achieve those goals. Or if we want to have God alone, then God will help guide us, but he won't fight for us. That's a very, very important point. We have to fight the battle, but God will help us in that fight. But he won't carry a weapon, and he won't bring his armies. But within that, it reminds me of a reporter that went to Swami Kriyananda in India and was writing an article and had a list of questions. And one of the questions was, Swami Kriyananda, do we need a guru? And Swami surprised everyone who were listening. He said, no, you don't need a guru. Why would you want somebody telling you what to do, how to act, how to behave? You don't need a guru, unless you want to find God. Then, of course, you need a guru. Well, that's the dilemma, see? Duryodhana says, I want your armies. Krishna says, I don't want the armies. I want you. That's all I want. All I want is you as my guru, because I know, Krishna, where you are, victory is. And so we, too, have that choice, and we make it daily. Every morning when we get up, we make a choice whether we want Krishna and only Krishna, or we want somehow to spend the time and the energy that's God-given in seeking things in this world that we think will make us happy. And so that's the first and great point at which we make a choice. Then the next point, as I said, I have five little points from the Gita that are kind of key things to hang ourselves on, our understanding on. The next point is when there's the despondency of Arjuna. So he goes out in the midst of this army, has asked Krishna to drive him out, and he looks and he sees all of the people on one side that he in the morning is going to have to put on his armor and do battle against and try to kill. And he says, those arranged before us are our own, and I'm going to read just without the interpretation here, and then I'm going to come back to the interpretation. Those ranged before us are our own teachers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, uncles, fathers-in-law, grandsons, brothers-in-law, and other kinsmen. Oh, Krishna, how can I consent to kill these relatives, even if their own desire is to kill me? I would rather relinquish sovereignty over the three worlds, what to speak of, the conquest over this little earthly kingdom. And he has his bow that nobody else has been able to string. It's so powerful except him. And he unstrings that bow and he slumps down in the chariot. And that's the despondency of Arjuna. And Krishna responds, the indwelling self is ever changeless, imperishable, and without limitation. Only these fleshly garments can be destroyed. Therefore, O offspring of Bharata, offspring of the light, accept your duty and fight. That's what just about took me off the path. Because Krishna builds up to it a little bit that says, you can't really slay these people. If you kill their bodies, they aren't really dead. We have past incarnations. We'll have future incarnations. Go ahead and kill them. You aren't really killing them. Well, this was 1967. It was in the midst of the Vietnam War. I had been in the Navy as a ROTC student, and I had relinquished that and become a conscientious objector. And I was, during that time, in danger of being taken and thrown into prison for not going along with what the U.S. military wanted me to do. And here Krishna is telling me, you should go ahead and fight. Killing all those Vietnamese, that isn't going to really, they aren't really going to die. Go ahead and fight. Do that. That was what I had in my own mind anyway. And that just about took me off the path. If it hadn't been for the fact that I had faith in Swamiji and faith in Master because I'd read the autobiography and other kinds of energy that held me, magnetism that held me there, I would have probably left at that point. And I have read of many people who give, quote, reviews of the Bhagavad Gita, who says it's a masculine-oriented, warfare-mongering writing and don't pay any attention to it. And that was kind of my state there. But I had other forces, really grace, that was holding me on. And so on one level, there's this war. On one level, Arjuna's going to kill all these people. But on another level, it is inner tendencies, the downward-pulling tendencies that everybody has to fight, and that's what he's got to fight against. Now I'm going to reread this thing that I read, the quote that I read, only I'm going to read what the meaning of teachers and fathers and sons are. So, those ranged against us are our own past teachers, or inclinations toward and hopes for attaining false worldly desires and ambitions. Fathers, or begetters of past sense inclinations, sons, or the sense pleasures themselves, grandfathers, sense tendencies from past incarnations, uncles, fathers-in-law, grandsons, brothers-in-law, and other kinsmen, or more distant influences, global, national, social, environmental, and familial influences. So now I'll reread it, not with the names, but those ranged against us are our inclinations toward and hopes for attaining false worldly desires and ambitions, begetters of past sense limitations, sense pleasures themselves, sense tendencies from past incarnations, or more distant influences of global, national, social, environmental, and familial tendencies. Because those are the influences that we think that we want to hold on to. Now, Krishna goes on to explain that if you kill those tendencies in yourself, see, we have the fear, the subconscious fear, that if we kill all of those familial past tendencies, we're going to essentially wipe out our whole personality, our whole being, who we are. And there won't be anything left of us. There'll be this kind of placid, whimpering, unenergetic, uninterested mess sitting there. And so why should we get rid of everything that seems to make up who we are? But Krishna says, you can't really kill them. What happens is that they're reincarnated in another form. And so we can't kill our tendencies, but we can kill off the manner in which those are expressing, and then they will re-express in a higher way. And that's what Krishna is telling Arjuna in the front of this in between the armies. And so that bucks up Arjuna. And then he goes on and he agrees to fight. Now, the next main point that I want to cover is that at this point, Krishna now begins to teach Arjuna. He begins to give him the spiritual teachings. He's obviously already told him to fight, But now he's telling him what to fight for, how to fight, what to do. And so the first thing that he addresses is action in this world. Because what Master said our path is a combination of meditation and service. And so Arjuna now is being addressed by Krishna, and Krishna is explaining what activity in the world means for the devotee. And he says, Krishna says, perform those actions which your duty dictates, for action is better than inaction. Without action, indeed, even the act of maintaining life in the body would not be possible. The true renunciate and the true yogi are those who perform dutiful actions without desiring their fruits, not those who, eschewing self-offering, act with ego motivation, nor those who eschew action, meditation, eschew action, and do so because of kind of false renunciation, spiritual false renunciation. So Krishna now is telling Arjuna that he has to act in this world. It's his dharmic duty. It's his righteousness. He's told him before that if he doesn't fight, if he doesn't act, that he'll be laughed at by his peers. His life will be worthless. Krishna goes on to explain that everybody has to find that dharmic action for them, for their own particular growth, and we have to do that dharmic action. So one of the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita is what's called nishkam karma. Karma means action. We have to act. But nishkam karma means act in such a way that it brings about freedom, not bondage. And the real essential teachings is that we do our actions out of a sense of righteousness, out of a sense of duty, or even better, out of a sense of self-offering to God and to serving God. And if we do that, that those actions free us from the tendency to be drawn downward. If we act in order to get something for ourselves, fame or recognition or appreciation or money, you know, the unions don't exactly have it right spiritually, nor do the bosses have it exactly right when they get into these enormous battles over who can save money or who can get money from each other, because it makes the whole of the work activity into a battle between what I get out of it or what I can prevent you from getting out of it. And it has nothing really to do with right action for the devotee. We should act because we're doing it for God and Guru. And this path of ours is one that requires incredible action, intense activity. Master told this to Swamiji. He said, your life is one of intense activity and meditation. He put meditation second. Why? Why for us who are part of Master's mission, part of Master's path, is intense activity first and meditation second? Partly because Master came with a world mission to do. He came at a time of changing ages, and his incarnation this time around was in order to help uplift the whole consciousness of the world. And there's a lot of work to be done. How? What kind of work? Well, Master wrote some books, and he said to Swami, you should write some more books. So Swami's written 150 more. That's what's meant by intense activity. He said, I have tried to create a colony. You should help with that. So Swami has gone on to create a whole worldwide work. And we're all here in order to help Swami and help Master and help manifest that because that mission is changing the lives of millions and millions of people in this world and uplifting them at this time. We're also needing to do it because Krishna tells Arjuna that he should do it, and Master tells us that we should do it. We have to act. And if for no other reason than to follow the advice of the Guru, we have to act. Now, next time around, Master said he would incarnate in 200 years, and he would live in the Himalayas with a small band of followers. He didn't say how small. Maybe it would include us. We can have high hopes here. But if we're part of that small band, his advice to us, I would imagine in that lifetime, is going to be different. He would say, your life is one of intense meditation and a little activity. But it's a different balance here. So we have intense action to do in this lifetime, and that is our way to freedom. See, all of these indicate our way to freedom. Okay, the fourth point to take away from the Gita. Meditation, and especially Kriya Yoga, brings victory. In the Gita are these quotes. One practice of yoga offers the incoming breath, the prana, into the outgoing breath, the apana, and the apana into the prana, thereby through pranayama rendering breathing unnecessary. And another quote, even a little practice of this inward religion will free one from dire fears and colossal suffering. So this is the end meditation part of the intense activity and meditation. Without meditation, intense activity will not be directed properly. It'll get off course. It's like a powerful rocket without those little steering mechanisms that direct its course. Yeah, it can be intense and it can shoot, but without steering it properly, it doesn't go in the right direction and it becomes destructive. Without meditation, our lives will become destructive. Now, the specific quote here is referring, Master said directly, although slightly obscurely, a direct quote referring to Kriya Yoga, where by doing pranayama, we make breathing unnecessary, and that allows the deep state of meditation where we realize our unity with God. And that daily practice of meditation is extremely important for us because it is what connects us to God, to Krishna, and to our own higher self. If you think about, remember I said that the Pandavas represented the five chakras and the Kauravas represent the outward going energy that goes out through the senses? The practice of pranayama takes that outward going energy that is enlivening and empowering the forces of the Kauravas, the downward pulling tendencies, it takes that energy from them and it brings them back and it gives them to the Pandavas. It brings the outward energy, pranayama brings that in to the central spine and recharges or opens up and redirects the energy from the chakras. The five Pandava brothers represent those five chakras. Krishna represents the sixth, or the point between the eyebrow. And so pranayama, the practice of Kriya Yoga especially, is specifically meant to bring that energy inward and direct it upward. And then the final point, which is the takeaway point of all takeaway points, is absorb your mind and heart in God. Absorb yourself in me. Be wholly devoted to me. Worship and bow to me alone. So shall you undoubtedly reach me. This I promise you faithfully, for you are dear to me. That's Krishna's promise to Arjuna. It's Krishna's promise to us. that if we will absorb our minds in God and in Guru, then we will reach him, and he promises us that. So the most important point to take away from the Gita is this point to keep our mind and our hearts turned toward God. Now we're going to hear in the other scriptures the exact same advice put in different words. But this is, one could say, the central message of the scriptures to everyone. So now we get to see Devi will play the Vanna White part. And we get to see what was on the board.
I don't think people know.
Oh, they don't know.
Some do.
Forget it. Pure and deeply spiritual reference to some of those social activities that Krishna was referring to here. So here are the 5 points, the 5 takeaway points. Now I want to end by saying that I've talked about this in terms of basically the way we should lead our lives. But the Gita especially also refers, you could interpret the whole Gita, read the whole Gita, and interpret it as advice for meditation, or even a single meditation. And so, choose God and Guru. When we wake up in the morning, we have a choice. Everybody in the world has a choice. They can start their day by just going about daily activities, trying to accumulate whatever they're trying to accumulate, and they don't give a thought to God or a thought to Guru, and they certainly don't meditate. But we as devotees, when we wake up, our first obligation is to kneel humbly at the foot of the bed so Krishna looks up and he sees us, and to say, this day I want you, I want only you, you are dear to me, that's all I want. And then to go into our meditation room. If we don't do that, the rest of the Gita in terms of meditation becomes irrelevant to us. Yes, it's still true on surface levels. Yes, it's still true on psychological levels. But for the deep devotee, it doesn't hold as much. But if we make that choice, not Duryodhana's choice, I was speculating, kind of, it was one of those fun kinds of things where your mind begins to play with an idea. I was playing with the idea yesterday, what would happen if Arjuna, given the first choice, had said, I want the army? What would happen? Now what I came up with was, there wouldn't be any war. War would be avoided, because either Duryodhana would say, oh my goodness, he's got the armies. All I've got is this guy with a chariot. I can't win. I give up. He would sue for peace. But secretly, what he would be thinking of is, why should I fight? I've already won. Arjuna, he's on my side now. He thinks that he's going to find his happiness through the world. And so, I don't know, you can play with that concept, see what you come up with, but that's what I came up with yesterday. So in the morning when we wake up, we are at we're at the bed of Krishna, and Krishna opens his eyes, because that's us opening our eyes, and he says, what do you choose? And if we choose him, then we go and meditate and try to go deeper. Okay, fight old habits and tendencies. Now, when we go into meditation, that's what's holding us back from going deep, are the old tendencies that we have. And unless we decide that we're going to get rid of those tendencies, we are not ever, ever going to achieve a depth of meditation. We have to. We will quickly, as Arjuna did in the scene in the Gita, he unstrung his bow. The bow is this part of the chest, and the string is the spine, and we're sitting there in meditation, and we look around and we say, uh-oh, I'm not going to give up all those desires and tendencies and just follow Krishna. And I'm not going to do that. Look at all. It's my father's. It's my family. It's everything familiar to me. Am I going to give all that up? I don't think so. And we unstring our bow and we slump down. And so that's for people whose meditation lasts 5 minutes and who don't really want to go deeper. We'd better keep our bow strong, because the bow represents the weapon that we're going to, the straight spine, the astral spine, is the weapon by which we're going to fight against those old familiar tendencies, and we, every one of us has them. They're different patterns. They're different things that we carry from the past. In the Bible, it says, the sins of the father shall be visited unto the son, unto the seventh generation. When I read that too, just about threw me off the path. That doesn't seem fair, does it? Well, the father is your past incarnations. And what it means is that the tail of your past incarnations, the tendencies, the sins are nothing more than your unknowing, your mistakes. Those sins hang along with you for at least seven generations, seven incarnations. So that's the tendencies that we're fighting against. Now, I don't know whether it's literally true. I never saw Master specifically address that. I'm just taking that as an interpretation. But I do know that when we sit to fight, we're fighting against those old familiar tendencies in us. And that's what we're trying to become free of. Because if we don't kill those off and become free from them, we don't become liberated and we don't go into the uplifted states that meditation promises. So here I'm interpreting only as meditation. Act for and with inner freedom. This is action in meditation. Now we can meditate with kind of the desire, okay, God, I'm going to give you this much time. I'm going to give you an hour of meditation, but you got to keep your part of the bargain here. You got to get me that parking place. You got to get me that job. You've got to help my family. You've got to help my health. So we want the fruits of the action. But what Krishna is saying, act, meditate without any desire for what the fruits are, even enlightenment. Don't meditate because God is going to give you enlightenment. Meditate because it's righteous and your service to God and Guru. He'll come back around at the end here at number 5, and he will give you himself. But if you sit there and meditate saying, okay, I'll give you this much time, Krishna, but you'd better come and come back to me. Otherwise, tomorrow I'm not so sure I'm going to give you this much time. See the difference? Action without the fruits of action. Meditation without the kind of merchant consciousness that can go with so many meditations. Okay, meditation, especially Kriya, brings victory. That withdrawal of energy and the offering it up to the point between the eyebrows, which represents Krishna, frees us from those past tendencies. That's the tendencies reside in the spine as samskars, or as little vortices. And the practice of Kriya burns up those vortices. That's what we do in the fire ceremony every Sunday. We throw those seeds of rice in to the fire. This is the fire of meditation. Those tendencies, seeds of karma, are in the spine. We cast them into the fire. Kriya casts those seeds into the fire. Meditation casts those seeds into the fire. And we're released from them. And they're burnt up and we're purified. But we can't do that without the techniques and without the grace of God and Guru in our practice of those techniques. So the practice of meditation and Kriya Yoga in that particular meditation will free us from those things, free us from dire fears and colossal sufferings. And then finally, if in meditation, especially after, we're talking about a single meditation here, after the practice of Kriya, after the practice of the techniques, then Krishna says, absorb yourself in me. I'll read it. Absorb yourself in me. Be wholeheartedly devoted to me. Worship me and bow to me alone. So shall you undoubtedly reach me. This I promise you faithfully, for you are dear to me. So at the end of our meditation, we take that inward energy, the energy that has been accumulated through the victory of the Pandavas over the Kauravas. And after the practice of Kriya, after the battle, we offer that energy wholeheartedly into the light at the spiritual eye or the sound of Om in this frontal region. And if we do that wholeheartedly, then the promise of Krishna, the promise of God, is that he will come to us. And that's the message of the Gita.